Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of And Then There's That, a bi-weekly podcast of people, politics, and punditry in Howard County on the HOCO Mojo Network. I'm Paul Scalney, and I'm here at the Mall in Columbia with my co-host, Dennis Lane. On today's show, Dennis and I will talk about sequestration, the political fundraising season, and the road from the head of economic development to Anne Arundel County exec. Go Laura. And joining us today is Michael McCall of Strategic Leisure, who had just a little bit to do with the design and creation of the Inner Arbor plan for Symphony Woods. But as always, first we're going to take a look at some of the headlines making the news this week. Dennis, what do you have to get us started?
Happy Sequestration Day. I mean, the world supposedly ended at midnight last night.
Or is it tonight? What the hell does it mean anyway?
You know, that's very funny. I'm coming in to work this morning, I'm listening on the radio, and they had some commenter on. He goes, just as indicative of how much Congress can't agree on it. They can't even agree when midnight was. You know, was it midnight last night? Was it midnight tonight? He said, I'm splitting them in the middle. I'm calling it noon today. So noon is the
look. This whole mess has been political since day one. But what's making me crazy is how the White House, and I'm going to blame the White House for this one, is creating pain for the average citizen. This is such a small amount of money in the grand scheme of the federal debt and the federal budget. And they're imposing cuts in exactly those places where it hurts the average citizen the most. TSA.
Yeah, but they have no choice on it. They set this thing up.
I think there's some flexibility as to where the cuts come from.
From my understanding, there's no discretion.
No.
It
tells you how much I know about sequestration.
And I feel bad because in our audience here in Howard County, we certainly have a lot of federal workers.
We do.
And they're going to bear the brunt of this Donnybrook between the Republicans and the Dems and Congress. And I just a pax on both of their houses. But anyway,
we have what
this is a local show.
Some odd 50,000 people, but it does impact Howard County.
It does.
We have some 50,000 county residents that are either federal employees or work for contractors of the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, we're going to feel it. We're going to feel it through the contracting. And like
we have 300,000 people. I mean, that's a sixth of our
right.
It's a lot. Workforce. Yeah,
it's a lot.
It's a lot.
And then, you know, like you said, then there's the add-ons. I mean, the people that service those people and, you know, the restaurants
and the dry cleaners. And
just, you know, right on down the line. So, yeah, it's a mess. But this is a local political show, and so we should talk about local politics. And we're entering into the spring fundraising season.
For everyone who's not in Annapolis, taxes and calling, revenue enhancements.
Revenue enhancements and gun control.
Right.
And wind farms. Let's not forget wind farms. You know, somehow wind farms seem very appropriate for them in Annapolis. They're so full of wind anyway down there. It's the perfect thing for them to be working on.
It's not really what you wanted to say, but you chose not to because it wouldn't be appropriate to say it on the air. I know you, Dennis.
We try to keep the show kind of nice, I suppose.
Kind of clean.
Spring fundraising. Season though, and we have I received in the mail a Courtney Watson fundraising link. She's gearing up to announce for something, maybe this spring.
I got hers as well, and I got Jen Tarasa's in the mail yesterday.
Yeah, but my funniest one was last night. John Weinstein, and John ran for delegate, I think, last time around in the 2010 cycle, and he unfortunately lost. He was going up against Warren Miller and Gail Bates in that district. But he held a fundraiser last night. I think he had initially intended to announce for something, but he just said, "I'm running for something."
In Howard County. I'm just not sure what.
Give me money.
I'm looking for opportunities.
Now, I should say, John has said before that he when he's ready to announce, he would do it on our show. So maybe that's why he couldn't announce last night. But I think it was another reason. I think there's a waiting game. I can't announce until you announce.
And who do we have on that we spoke to? Doug Gansler.
Yeah.
And we talked about this whole notion of...
Well, he says the media creates this.
Of announcing. And
right.
He said it's the media that creates this whole mess about who announces and when and how long should you wait. He says we candidates don't care.
Bull hockey.
Of course it's bull hockey. You wanted to say that word again. That's twice.
Speaking of politicians.
So Anne Arundel County has a new county executive, former county executive whose name escapes me.
John Leopold,
who got himself in a little bit of hot water.
Yeah.
Resigned. Was forced to resign. And the county council.
What a piece of work he was, you know.
Some of those stories were unreal.
Having his staff change his catheter bag. Come on, man.
Was that in a written job description? I mean, Come on.
Talk about dirty jobs.
Pun intended. Anyway, so Lauren Newman, who is from Anne Arundel County and who has worked in Howard County.
Now we know she's a Republican.
Well, I think we knew that.
I didn't.
Yeah, I knew she was a Republican, and she worked as the head of the Howard County Economic Development Authority.
CEO.
Since Dick Story resigned a little over a year ago.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Just over a year. She wasn't in that long.
And so the county council of Anne Arundel County had to appoint somebody to take Leopold's place, and it had to be a Republican because he was a Republican. And there were some 16 people that put in their name, including former First Lady Kendall Ehrlich.
Yeah.
And you and I talked about this 2-3 weeks ago when we first saw Laura Newman's name, and we were like, really? I mean, she's not actively politically involved in Anne Arundel County right now. She's a resident there. She ran businesses there. But I think we were all kind of surprised.
But,
lo and behold, they appointed her.
They did. But a local Politico, who I will not name names, when I said, gee, I'm a little surprised that she actually threw her hat into that ring, turned to me and said, she wouldn't have applied if she didn't think she had a pretty good chance of getting it. So,
it was interesting. They interviewed several of the council members in Anne Arundel County, and several of them not only did not know her, but they had never heard of her prior to the hearing.
Right. So, they know all the other candidates down there. They've had enough of their stuff. So they said, how can we go wrong? Let's pick somebody from good old perfect Howard County, the second best place to live.
I'm wondering what the backstory on that one is, and I'm sure there's some help she got along the way.
Well, as a Republican, it's interesting. She won, even though the Republicans have a majority in the county. She won by getting all 3 Democratic votes.
Right. It was a bipartisan vote.
Yeah. Well, she had 1 Republican vote and 3 Dem votes, and that was enough to win the day.
Right.
So did Ken pick up a phone and talk to some Dem council members? I don't know. But
And then Larry Tweel, who has been acting as...
that's a funny name to pronounce. You know,
Tweel?
When you look at it in writing, T-W-E-L-E. I've mispronounced that more times than I've...
It wants to have 2 E's.
It's almost like Scalney. It's one of those hard ones.
It's just a messed up name. So he's been Laura Newman's executive vice president for the Howard County EDA, and he took over her position, and he got a...
He's a good guy.
He's a very good guy.
Like
I think
Larry.
He'll do well, and I'm wishing him a lot of luck.
I wonder if he'll get a $250,000 salary, too.
I don't think that's what she was making.
what we're referring to, of course, is that Laura made a big... when she took the job as Anne Arundel County executive, she made a big deal out of the fact she's taking a $100,000 paycheck. And, well, the Anne Arundel County executive pays $130,000 a year, so I do the math. That means that she must have been making close to $250,000 to promote Howard County, one of the easiest places in the world to promote. I mean.
But as former County Executive Leopold has established, there are lots of perks of being County Executive that are not necessarily monetary.
If you ever need your catheter bag changed, oh no, that's a good way to get out of office. Okay, so what do we have next? Speaking of County Execs, our County Exec got a recognition again. Ken has been recognized by, what is it, I'm looking for the name of the magazine here.
It's the Government Technology Magazine.
The Government, there it is.
And he got the top 25 doers, dreamers, and drivers for 2013.
Yeah.
Who the hell came up with that award name? God.
The doers, good for Ken. I mean, he's done a great job. There it is. Save my article. And he was one of 4 elected officials in the country to get the award, along with Newark Mayor Cory Booker, California Senator Alex Padilla, and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. That's pretty
That's very impressive.
Pretty heady company. But Allman was chosen for his leadership in the development and construction of the Intercounty Broadband Network. That was supposed to go live this summer, right?
You know what? It took a lot of leadership to do that. It's going to have unbelievable impact on the connectivity of institutions around the state and frankly, beyond. And then businesses, too.
Absolutely. So kudos to Ken.
Yeah, nice job.
You get that magazine, right?
What magazine was that again?
Yeah, right. Well, it's big in those circles, I'm sure.
And then from the... Wow.
We've had hand trucks.
Well, earthquake coming through. Stand by. The Watershed Protection and Restoration Program. Let's talk about that a little bit. So this is a law that was passed by the state last year, and it requires larger counties, including Howard County, to collect fees to actually pay for stormwater management as well as stream and wetland restoration projects.
All to help the Bay, I'm sure.
All to help the Bay. At least that's the story. Many think it's another hidden tax.
Yeah.
But look, it will help the Bay, but it's, in my opinion, is another fee that's being sold as a revenue enhancement, which is really just another tax.
Yeah, it's going to go on your property tax bill, I guess. And they
so the county council is looking at this, and it came before them last week. I think they're supposed to vote on it this coming Monday. But the bill before the county is proposing for basically for every 500 square feet of impervious surface, property owners will be charged $7.80. And this is going to be on their tax bill. And they have some demarcations for homes built before and after 2002, and they have some exceptions for agricultural properties. But by and large, it's going to be a tax that's going to raise about $7 million in fiscal 14 for the county.
Yeah, according to the thing, and actually could go up in years coming. The average homeowner, I think, was going to get with like a $39 extra fee on their property tax bill. So.
And, you know, my frustration is these are the kind of little hidden fees that we continuously as taxpayers have to face, whether it's an increase in MVA, whether it's an increase in, you know, a hidden property tax. Most people barely even look at their property tax bill because their mortgage company actually pays it out of escrows. So, yeah, my property taxes went up. You know, it kind of gets hidden. It kind of gets brushed under the carpet.
It's like another $1.50 on your electric bill to pay for wind farms. I mean, when is a fee a tax? What is a tax a fee? These and other heavy questions will be addressed in future shows. And then there's that. On a more positive note, finally, after years of stagnation, Wild Lake is starting to get its do-over. Wild Lake Village Green, I'm talking about Columbia's first shopping center, which maybe our guest can comment on as a planner. It was one of the first village center in Columbia, and certainly one of the model for all the village centers to follow. And now will be the first one to really enter into the really reuse phase, where they reallocate its retail percentage into a residential component. I think Harper's Choice Village Center was actually the only village center that experimented with having apartments above the stores, but this kind of takes it to a new level. It'll be like
250?
Yeah, 250 units. And they've announced they've
got a five-story apartment complex.
Yeah, and they've just signed up a CVS drugstore, which would be great for that community. I mean, they haven't had a grocery store. CVS is good.
Well, they're taking down the giant building, and I think they're actually taking down the Crown gas station, too, aren't they?
Yeah.
Replacing something else.
The gas station, good. And they're going to, and David's, they're going to move to the old Produce Galore space, or probably we're going to reconfigure that, I'm sure, in some way. But that's nice. They're going to keep David's and kind of build
it's
on
kind the lone survivor over there in some respect. And you know what? I'm glad they're finding a way to work with
him. He's got a good regional following, and then good to build it up. But you know, it's just indicative of other things. You know, here in the mall, they've already started. I mean, they got bulldozers working on the expansion already. They've got the old Merrill Lynch office building is getting a major do-over of its lobby area and entries. I mean, Clyde's is well underway. I mean, it's all boarded up, and they're doing some. They actually started putting a new front on that.
I think they have. Yeah.
I understand later on this month, Howard Hughes will actually be moving out of the Rouse building and into some new quarters in the teachers building above, or like the Columbia Association building above Clyde's. And then that work will commence in the redoing of the Rouse building.
Is that about to start as well?
Yeah, that's where they're moving out to make room for that to get underway. So town center is rocking and rolling.
Finally happening.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And then just up the street, we have Merriweather that's been the subject of a little bit of news in the last several months with noise legislation. And you know, many often wonder why we were doing this. And what this, of course, I'm referring to is the state delegation passing a law that disallows the local government from capping the decibel levels that can emanate from Merriweather. And that did pass the Howard County delegation just earlier this week
with one
dissenting vote, Liz Bobo.
Go
figure.
And
it's her district.
And Liz loves Merriweather, she says. But, and I guess the bottom line, and it said, does not mean Merriweather will be any louder or anything will be really different. It just really codifies the law to reflect how it's been operating.
Right.
But I loved it. Guy Gazzone was quoted in Blair Ames' piece in the Baltimore Sun, and it says he has absolutely zero concern about this bill creating more noise for nearby residents. His quote was, "I believe firmly this will be a great, uneventful concert season."
If that's what a success is in Guy's eyes, that's great.
But a place that hosts events, how can it be uneventful? I'm sorry. Maybe I'm parsing words there. Before I introduce my guest, though, I just want to say one more thing. We had a Tuesday night, Jesse Newbern and Hoco Blogs hosted yet another one of their blogtail parties, and it was great. These things have gotten, you know, Jesse's taken these things from a handful of people too. I think we had like close to 80 people at this at Union Jack's on Tuesday night. And really, what it is a gathering of writers, only writers who are generally focused on things around here. And it was phenomenal. It was a great event. Had some very nice comments about the podcast from people. So thank you for those who came up to me and said anything that night. And you know, look forward to Jesse doing more of these. And kudos to her. She's done a great job and to bring that community together. This is one of the only few places I know that bloggers actually get together socially. I mean, generally that. That doesn't
well, and I suspect it's the evolution. You know, newspapers probably had their newspaper association, and you know, blogging is a fairly new thing. And I suspect that over time there'll be you know the National Association of Bloggers and things like that. And I suspect these kinds of events are the genesis of those kind of organizations and programs and.
Yeah, that was great.
Nonprofit associations that support that industry.
And not only, I got to meet a couple of bloggers I hadn't met before, but I also got to meet people who actually comment on blogs and read blogs, and it was great feedback. It was really interesting. Anyway, without further ado, welcome to our guest, Michael McCall.
Welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks
for joining us.
Michael is the president and CEO of Strategic Leisure. Is that the right title? Or
that
or
is.
Chief Visionary?
President will do.
There's so many chief positions out there. I can't be Chief Technology Officer and this and that.
Strategic Leisure is headquartered here in Columbia.
It is.
And has been always? Or
yes, yeah. Since 1982. And I think someone at this table helped find some space for me.
But back a long time ago.
Yes,
yeah,
you
yeah,
did.
Yeah. Michael,
his real job.
Well, the reason why we've asked Michael to join us today is he is the designer, conceptualizer. I mean, how would you... Author of the Inn Arbor Woods plan?
Protagonist.
Which you
protagonist officer.
You've begun to learn more about the county than you ever really
yes,
cared to.
Yes, exactly.
Welcome. Tell us a little about yourself and how you came to Symphony Woods.
Yeah. Well, I could have walked because I lived 2 miles from here. But I came to work for Jim Rouse in 1982 when he was the head of... I just had formed. I was the fourth employee, actually, of the Enterprise Development Company.
He had retired.
He'd retired from the Rouse Company. He was still chairman, but he was no longer CEO. And he started the Enterprise Foundation, now Enterprise Community Partners. And that was two people. The Enterprise Foundation was two people when I joined the Enterprise Development Company. So I was the fourth employee of the Enterprise Development Company.
And that's when the company was marching around the world doing smaller town festival marketplaces.
Exactly. Going places that the Rouse Company probably wasn't going to spend much time in. And the idea was to make money for our shareholder, which was the Enterprise Foundation, and do some good for cities like Toledo and Flint and Richmond and Norfolk and those types of second-tier cities as opposed to Miami or New York where the Rouse Company was very busy.
Right.
And then you worked with the Rouse Company for some time and Enterprise, and then you left and started your own thing? Or
I worked for Jim at Enterprise for a decade, 82 to 92. I sort of look at that term in three segments that were not quite even in time, but more or less. I did development directing of festival marketplaces. And then I headed up the Rouse side of a joint venture with the Walt Disney Company from 85 to 88.
Yeah, that was a fascinating chapter. That's when Disney teamed up with... A lot of people don't know about that. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I actually heard, working in Flint, on the festival marketplace in Flint, I heard that a rumor, you wouldn't think you'd hear this in Flint, Michigan, but some Disney people were working on something called Auto World.
Oh, yeah. I remember that, yeah.
And so the rumor was that Disney was thinking about going into cities. And Frank Wells and Michael Eisner had been in power for about 3 years. And you could just, if you just tracked what they did in the Wall Street Journal, you could see, like, they had a checklist of how to leverage the assets of the Walt Disney Company, which were considerable, but had been left fallow for quite a while. And so I brought home that rumor to Jim Rouse, and he got in touch with Frank Wells, the president of the Walt Disney Company, whom he knew. And sure enough, it was on their agenda, and they thought, well, what better thing to explore that opportunity to go into cities than with Jim Rouse, who had obviously been very successful in entertaining people in a casual way.
There's a lot of synergy there between the two companies.
Absolutely.
You know, Rouse always saw retail as theater. And that was certainly right up Walt Disney's.
Exactly. So it was a tremendous experience for me personally, because I had a team, at Enterprise, my Disney team. But our team got to work across four different groups at the Walt Disney Company, which started with strategic planning, corporate strategic planning, Disney development, the real estate guys, and Imagineering, the creative team, and then the operators in Florida. And because Disney's, at that time at least, was a relatively politicized large company with a lot of competition internally, if we would have been a part of Disney directly, I probably wouldn't have had the luxury to work with all those groups in the same way. So it was...
Right,
because
you were then maybe 20 employees or something like that.
Enterprise?
Enterprise Development, yeah.
We got up to 60 at some point, but my team was about 10% of that. Right, we had about six people on the team. And anyway, it was a tremendous experience. We never built anything, unfortunately.
Yeah, how many plans did you lay out? I mean, what cities did you go into?
Three major plans and some other diversions. But the first was in Dallas, a super block that was available at the time. It was 12 acres, right up McKinney Avenue.
Right.
And... that was the first one that we planned. And when I say planned, it's the, you know, physical planning, the creative storytelling, but it's also the economics, the attendance, the per caps, the whole development strategy. And then we went to Chicago, which was my personal favorite, because the idea was to actually take over Soldier's Field. Which the McCaskey family wanted a new stadium, which, of course, they eventually got in Soldier's Field. But the thought at the time, at least, was to build a new stadium nearby. And we thought, well, boy, we could have a lot of fun with the redevelopment of that right on Burnham Harbor.
Right.
Make no small plans, Burnham Harbor. And then Burbank, because the Universal was threatening to do what they eventually did, which was City Walk in Universal City, California, in Burbank. And so
Disney wanted to protect their franchise.
Disney said, you know what, we can play this game too, and we worked on that, and that is now the proud home of, I think, of a IKEA store right along the 5.
So you had three major metropolitan areas that kind of gave you a baptism into selling things to a community.
You know, I mean, actually, we had governors taking us on helicopter rides. Governor Thompson
cool
of Illinois. So it
doesn't Ken have a helicopter?
I don't know.
The county has a helicopter. I'm pretty sure of that. But anyway, it was a little different situation. You know, primarily, I mean, Jim Rouse certainly helped. But I think probably the big partner in the deal was the Walt Disney Company, and the thought of having them come to Chicago or any one of these places was pretty attractive.
So how did you transition to having your own business?
So just the last segment, which will lead into that answer, the last segment of my career with Rouse was I headed up international consulting. So basically taking that whole development strategy thing that I just described and taking it down the road, because mayors and governors and so on from all over the world would come knock on Jim's door and say, please,
give us a Panel Hall Marketplace.
Yeah, exactly.
Harbor Place.
Yeah, I gave many, many tours of the Inner Harbor to a lot of Japanese and other folks. And so I got a chance to work in Singapore and Australia.
That's
great. Japan the most, actually, and some in Europe. And Newark, New Jersey, where we helped site the what became NJPAC, which is a very been very successful, New Jersey Performing Arts Center, and they've done a great job there. So
I thought it was Political Action Committee there for a minute.
No. So So I'd gone through this cycle many times as far as, you know, the strategy, the positioning, the design, the economics, the attendance, all that stuff, and started Strategic Leisure to do that as a business.
Okay, so how big is your company now?
The company is 3 people.
Okay.
But then there's a whole squadron of contractors around the country, and, yeah, around the world to a certain extent. Who we've worked with for years, and it works out very well for us.
Walk us through a little bit now. You weren't exactly approached by CA.
No.
Tell us this. I've heard the story. Can you share with it how you came to Symphony Woods?
Well, as I was explaining a little bit before we got on the air here, having lived in Columbia for 30 years, all my work was, as I sort of just described, I was getting on airplanes and some trains, but, you know, nothing local, basically. And
you're one of those people who probably couldn't name your county council rep.
That's Mary Kay. I salute you, Mary Kay Siggety. She's the best.
And how I imagine that's changed in the last 60 days.
But I really didn't pay attention. I'll be very honest about that. And it was really kind of conscious. I mean, in other words, you know, I had to, in Tennessee, I worked with the Corps of Engineers, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Cherokee Indians, and the Tennessee Department of Environmental Conservation.
And you didn't need to come home and do that again, right?
Yeah, and, you know, we exactly. I mean, after spending 2.5 years getting some incredible permits, but, you know, that no one thought we could get, but we got them. But, you know, I just sort of, you know, hunkered down and enjoyed. You know, we love living here. You know, we just lived here very, very happily. So to answer your question, though, Dennis, in the July of 2011, Barbara, who you know,
lovely lady,
the privilege of being her husband.
Hi, Barbara, if you're listening.
For the last 30 years.
She's a saint.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is, very much so. She handed me the flyer and said, you know, read this. And the story was about the design advisory panel basically panning the CA's submission. And this is like...
No, this is the design that Cy Pommier...
I believe he was the...
Was involved with.
Yeah. And... I read it. This, again, July 2011, so a long time ago. I read it, and I thought, well, I see the plan in the, you know, just in the flyer. And I you know, the critique that was given by the various members of the advisory panel, I thought made a lot of sense. And I thought, well, this will take care of itself. You know, this is process. This is, you know, progress, whatever. Greg Schwind, who is my neighbor down the path and also happens to be a member of the CA board, said, no, Michael, actually, this whole thing is moving, you know, at pace. And which really surprised me.
At pace? Is that good or bad?
Well, at pace, if the design that had just been panned was actually moving forward. Because it, as you probably know, the design advisory panel advises, they themselves, there are other mechanisms, to, you know, like the planning board,
right,
which can make, you know, legally binding commentary. But, and I thought, you know, that disturbed me because, you know, we can build, you know, I mean, if you build a building that's in the wrong place or it's not very attractive or whatever, you can tear it down. It's really expensive, you know, but...
But you can't lease it.
But you can't lease it, as you and I both know. But, you know, you can correct in a generation. You can correct a lot of, you know, development decisions in a 20-year, you know, time. Once you cut the trees down, I mean, you've made a decision for the next 100 years. And, you know, I just thought... In fact, we're here right below the Apple Store, and I met George Barker, who was my first boss, a wonderful gentleman. He and his wife, Ann, are just terrific.
Former general counsel for HRD, wasn't he?
He was general counsel of HRD and with the hospital and a man about town in business. But he was my first boss working for Jim Rouse. And my son is his one-to-one tutor up at the Apple Store.
It's a small town.
Yeah. And so I ran into George working with my son, Evan, and I said, George, I don't know what we can do about this, but I feel that Jim, I owe him so much, Jim Rouse.
Yeah.
For my career and for the wonderful place that we've lived in for 30 years. And I wanted to, I said, I don't know what we can do, but let's try.
We got to do something.
You got to try. And so I knew Ken Allman a little bit, not much. Met him a few times, but we made an appointment he understood our concerns, and he said, I'm going to introduce you to John DeWolf. Go talk to John, because John DeWolf, being the head of the senior vice president of Howard Hughes, uh-huh. and the owner of Meriwether. And so I sort of made my case, eventually he introduces me to Phil Nelson. And who is the head of CA. And I didn't know quite what to expect because, Phil's the CEO of the organization that was moving forward with the plan I didn't...
care for.
I wasn't enthused about. And he was a perfect gentleman. And he was just terrific, as a matter of fact. And when... the planning board then this past late summer, in fact, they issued, I think, their decision and order, as it's called, on September 6th, when the planning board said, we approve you, but with some very specific stipulations, which basically said that the plan that you submitted, it has pathways, it has hardscape, it has amenities. That's all great. We endorse that. But you have to come back with a different geometry, which meandering paths that do not cause, because of a design, the cutting down of trees. And so at that point...
meandering paths.
We got...
designers love terms like that, but isn't the shortest distance between two points a straight line?
Unless there's a tree in the way.
So... do you want me to tell you why I think what my grievance, if you will, or why I think the other plan is the wrong?
Absolutely.
Thank you for asking. I think a lot of the people that are very concerned about Symphony Woods, and there are many, and I want to say this right now. It's important that everybody that's concerned about it is doing so in good faith. And I really respect their passion and their caring. We disagree, but they're good people, and we're just looking at we're solving two different problems. And the word problem is not, it's two different opportunities.
Challenges, right.
Yeah. Meriwether, if you come out of Meriwether, I went to a concert at the beginning of last year, and I'm a development guy, I'm a design-oriented guy, I've been focused on this area of town, I've been driving by here for 30 years because that's, I live 2 miles away, and for about 15 seconds, I got disoriented because I came out. It was, dark and the canopy.
You've been drinking, haven't you?
No, I had not been drinking. No. There, but and then I thought, okay, there's the lights of the corporate center, and then I located myself, but I thought, what a wonderful thing that you can be right next to a 400,000 square foot mall, one of the best malls in the country. We're sitting in here right now, and all the office buildings, all this, development, and yet you can feel like you've escaped.
You're
right?
In the woods.
You're in Howard County in a lot of places.
Yeah. But to have that is that I live off of the Middle Patuxent Environmental Area,
mm-hmm. Oh,
which
yeah.
is fantastic to do that. But to have this kind of experience, this 50 acres of woods immediately across the street from and in the near future across the street from many millions of square feet more, it's just an incredible thing. And so the worst thing I think you could do is to start drawing straight lines through the woods in pedestrian malls, because basically it's saying we're going to assimilate you now into the city grid. You are now part of us, you know, and resistance is futile.
We happen to have trees, but you're still a part of us.
Yeah. I mean, and so, and what's, of course, ironic, and I think you guys know this better than I did because I wasn't paying attention back then, but The Columbia Association's impetus to get going on this was to make sure that other roads were not cut into this.
Yeah, and buildings. No buildings in.
Right. So I mean, so actually, we all felt the same basic tenet that, you know, Symphony Woods needed to be an incredible park. We just came at it in two different directions, and the direction that I felt strongly about is that the, you know, wide open spaces, and reminding everybody that it's, you know, next to the grid and assimilating into the grid, as I mentioned, was the wrong psychology, because the trees become a veil. In a psychological sense, it's what allows you to feel the sense of escape when you go there. And if you start penetrating the veil, just like in legal terms, you know, you start penetrating the veil, then it starts to break down. So
in your design, you really eliminated those straight lines and those grids. And obviously, this being a podcast, we don't have the benefit of being able to hold up your picture. But what you really tried to do was eliminate those straight lines and do those more meandering paths and meandering.
There's
roads.
A lot of squiggly lines in your plan.
There's a lot of squiggly lines. So we see the ground in three fundamental ways. If you think about starting at Little Patuxent and going south from there, the first band across parallel to the Little Patuxent Parkway is the public park, right? It's a more traditional park. It's for walking the dog. It's for having a picnic. It's for wine in the woods, certainly, now and forever. Those types of activities. The way in the far back of it, in an area that many people in Columbia and Howard County don't even realize exists, right. There was a botanical garden that the Rouse Company developed in 1967 along with Meriwether. And a pond is back there. And
it's funny, Michael, when he first showed it to me, he called it a botanical garden. In my years of working at Meriwether on the landscaping crews through college and high school.
That's where you smoked weed, isn't it?
No. It was the mosquito ponds. Before every concert, we would defoliate.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because the water didn't flow through there. It was stagnant and now they have fountains, I think, that helps.
They do have aerators, yes. Right. So
keeps the water moving.
That area we call the cure. These are planning terms. These are not branding labels, but in strategic planning terms, the curated park. Curated was, you know, curate the botanical, the plants and the trees, and also curate sculpture. Wow. So it's really a sculpture garden. And in the middle band between those two parks, we call this, by the way, a concerto in three parks is the way we...
Concerto in three parks.
Very nice.
The middle band is where Meriwether is, right? So that's that same... So if you just continue east of that, there's a big clearing. It's where there's a farmhouse today, and there's asphalt parking, and there's a grassy knoll, and you know, we thought, well, okay, let's make that the performance park, right? Because you already have this giant 10-acre anchor that gets 300 and some thousand people every year in concerts and everything. So let's make that the performance park and put the arts and cultural development there. And the arts and cultural development, to make sure everybody knows that all of that's called for strategically, not with tremendous specificity, but strategically called for. It's the law of the land, in essence, in the 2010 plan, which the county passed in January of 2010.
It's the arts component of the town center redevelopment.
Yes, right. And so... That's the essence of it. And then connecting those various areas, we have regular paths, and we also have an interesting feature, the tree-line elevated canopy walk, which is about 1,000 feet long and would have various tree houses along the way, but the tree houses aren't, you know, like we built with mom and dad in the, you know, in our childhood. They're pieces of art in of themselves, done, and they'll be done by different, you know, architects and designers.
Very cool.
Listen, there's lots of pieces to this, and we don't have time to go into all the different elements, but now that it's been approved, and we're you've got this new trust, which is a key element of this, to oversee the development of these woods. When, kind of walk us through when are things going to start to happen, and what might we see first, and when?
So the trust is just being formed. Of course, it was just 2 weeks ago, yesterday, that the CA
the
took
vote was Valentine's Day.
It was Valentine's Day. It was, I think, a tremendous gift to all of us. And
the board showed a little love for Columbia.
They showed a lot of vision and guts. I mean,
it was a bold
decision, and not just for the plan itself, but also for the mechanism to implement the plan, because
which is key.
Yeah, which is a trust that will be a 501c3 not for profit trust that is arm's length distance away in legal terms from Columbia Association, and the import of that is that we need to be arm's length in order to be a charity as opposed to a 501c4, which CA is, and the import of that is that we can attract grants and donations, and people can deduct those donations with the 501c3. So we're just in the formation stage. And we're mobilizing on all fronts, from design talent to, you know, opening bank accounts and everything in between.
Right, but physically, when will you start? I mean, part of this element is a CA headquarters. When do you see that happening?
So, the focus is we're going to do two parallel tracks here. One is we want to continue in the county planning process for, you know, the public park along Little Patuxent Parkway, and keep that moving and start building just as soon as possible. So that would be the first, you know, construction. I can't tell you exactly when that's going to be, but, you know, in the next year or two, you know, we'll see.
And that's the piece that includes an interactive sculpture? Is that
correct?
And, right. But that has to be commissioned, so you don't even know what that looks like yet.
Well, we're talking to an artist, and we're very excited about that, and so we're already moving. Nothing to announce, but we're moving. So that's one track is to pick up where CA left off, and to move that, and while that is happening, then do the more challenging planning on the Arts Village and the balance of the project, of the Inner Arbor project, which is, you know, fairly complex and will require a lot of different talents. And we need to do a business plan and an operating, you know, how are we going to operate this? It's not just what does it look like or where does it go, but it's also how does it work and how do we operate it? So we will do those two things at the same time. I think
but we could see a sculpture unveiled or a plan for a sculpture the summer.
That'd be a great thing to do.
But definitely in 2014, we'll start to see some activity.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, well, that's great.
Great. We're starting to run out a little time. There's lots to talk about here. I mean, there's the relocation of the Spear Center. There's the Toby's thing. But I guess we're gonna learn about that more over the coming months anyway. I mean, the bottom line, though, is you, from a community that you really just kind of came home and got away from work from, now you work at home.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It's kind of nice, though, to be able to leave a mark in your hometown.
You know, it's a lot of responsibility, and I certainly feel the weight of that.
Because now the neighbors can knock on your door and say, Michael, that sculpture you put in Symphony Woods?
Do you really like that?
Yeah, exactly. It's a very big opportunity, or big responsibility, rather, but it's also a tremendous opportunity. And I'm honored to be a part of it.
Well, and what a neat way to kind of pay back to your mentor, Jim Rouse.
Yeah, that's so. I would love for that to be the case.
So thanks for coming by today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Very informative.
That about wraps up yet another episode of Then There's That. Together with my co-host, Paul Scowney, we'd like to thank our producer, Dave Bittner, who makes us look good on the Internet. We'd also like to thank General Growth Properties and the Mall in Columbia for hosting our show again today. We'll be back again on March 15th with another edition of our Local Politics Roundtable Free-for-All, with Roger Kaplan on the left and Chris Oxenham on the right, along with our usual blend of hyper-local news and commentary. We hope you join us.